A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
And I said, I want to win the league, but I want to win it better. You can understand that, can't you?
Yes.
Good lad.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
Look, I know not everybody who listens to the Second Captains podcast is necessarily a massive rugby fan. There may even be one or two rugby haters walking amongst us.
No.
Yes, Murph, one or two. I've got some good news and some bad news for you lot. The bad news, you've probably guessed it, we're talking a bit of rugby today. The good news, we're going to talk about how the game is so busy chasing the glory and riches enjoyed by football that it's in danger of destroying itself. So, rugby chat, but with the proviso that the sport might completely implode pretty soon. A little bit of everyone, or a little bit for everyone in today's podcast. Hi, Murph, I can.
And apparently, with the implication that football, once again, is to blame for all these problems.
Football's once glorious again. Success, Ken. The game that ate itself.
Which one are we talking about now, Ruby?
Football supposedly ate itself 15 years ago. I remember there's a big Observer.
And yet still,
piece about that.
It exists.
I think
surely in a greatly diminished form from its heyday in the late 80s.
I think that piece was mostly focused on attendances and ticket prices and stuff.
Yes.
As opposed to the TV nature of things. But yeah, the rugby, I'm talking about Saracens in particular. They begin the defence of the Heineken Cup next weekend. But their director, rugby Mark McCall, has hinted strongly that they might not be too bothered with the competition this year. The club is currently facing a 35-point deduction in the Premiership and a big fine as well for breaching salary cap regulations. They're appealing this ruling, but they're going to work off the assumption that they are on minus points. They'll have to prioritise avoiding relegation rather than worrying too much about the Heineken Cup. So they say. I mean, they do have a pretty big squad, so maybe it's all manageable. But if you're combing through all the quotes for the last few days, searching for any words of support for Saracens from their competitors, you'll be a long time searching. This would be fairly typical stuff from Harlequin scrum half Danny Kerr.
You know, there's 11 other clubs in this Premiership who, I'm going to swear now, work their balls off from June up until May to maybe live that dream and lift the trophy at the end of the season. We managed to do it in 2012 and we did it fair and square in the cap, no cheating. For me, it's the highlight of my career. One of the greatest moments of my life was lifting that trophy along with getting married and the birth of my son. That's how much it means to me. And I just feel so sorry for all those other clubs, all those other players, backroom staff, coaches. People lose their jobs because they were not performing well enough because everyone's saying, why aren't we as good as Saracens? And if it comes out that that's happening because they're cheating, well, you know, it's not just the here and now. It affects people's lives. It affects people's families. And that's why I think so many players have been so annoyed over the years that it has been swept under the carpet. As you said, there was another one previously that got brushed aside. And for me, I don't think that the medal should stand. I don't think the trophy should stand. I think they should be whipped away from them because if they have been caught cheating and that's what we're going on, they don't deserve to have them. If you'd see something like that, you know, you'd say, right, Saracens, you've cheated for how many years? I know it says the last 3 years. Go and stick them in the Championship for that long and see if their players stay and want to play for them then.
A 3-year relegation would be fairly draconian, seeing as we're not entirely sure what exactly Saracens have done. There's only broad brushstrokes at the moment.
So Premier Rugby are refusing to release the results of the investigation. They're only saying,
look, they breached regulations.
Here's the punishment.
Yeah, so it's leaving a lot of speculation and all the rest of it. Hearsay swirling around the place.
Yeah.
It's a little odd, all right. We'll get into all of this quite shortly. As for Saracens, they don't feel like they've done anything wrong. Here's their forwards coach, Alex Sanderson, speaking to BT Sport after they beat Gloucester on Saturday.
I guess to quote the immortal words of Taylor Swift, hate is going to hate, 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 and play is going to play. I don't mean to belittle the scenario, I don't at all, but that's just our mentality, right? We're going to accept the hate that we're going to receive, and I don't think it's justified. I think it's misplaced and misguided. That's my opinion. But from the information that some people have, they're allowed to make their own decisions, their own opinions. We've used the anger this week to fuel us. You can't use that for a full season because it's a negative energy. So we've got to go on and crack on and look strategically about what we want to do this
season.
Yeah,
the Taylor Swift line. Very cute. Very cute. But it's pretty clear. Battle lines are drawn between Saracens and everybody else in rugby. Mike Aylwin wrote a piece in The Guardian this weekend about the dangers of clubs overreaching and how the structure of the entire sport is on trial. So we're going to get him on with Shane Horgan on today's show.
And they're going to tell us why it's football's fault, is that it?
Football might get a bashing as well, I'm sure.
Oh, good. No,
you've got to keep the rugby fans happy as well, you know.
Of course.
It's a broad,
as said,
broad church and all that.
Something for everyone.
The Nike Oregon Project, until recently home to many of America's top athletes, did not sound like it was a barrel of laughs to be involved in. I'm going to put it right out there. As far back as 2015, friend of the show, David Epstein, did some great reporting exposing some of the dubious practices that were being employed there. And last month, the training center was shut down for good after its founder and top coach Alberto Salazar received a 4-year ban for doping violations. But the grim news just keeps on coming. Late last week, an athlete called Mary Kane, who had been America's top young prospect at one point, she took part in a New York Times video series called Equal Play. In it, she detailed how the coaches at the Nike Oregon Project, led by Salazar, completely fixated on her weight and pressured her to get thinner, 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 with fairly devastating results.
When young women are forced to push themselves beyond what they're capable at their given age, they're at risk for developing REDS. Suddenly, you realize you've lost your period for a couple months. And then a couple months becomes a couple years. And in my case, it was a total of 3. And if you're not getting your period, you're not going to be able to have the necessary levels of estrogen to maintain strong bone health. And in my case, I broke 5 different bones.
That REDS that she mentions, it's something called Relative Energy Deficiency in Sports Syndrome. I have to say I'd never heard of it until I looked it up for the chat we're going to have today. And Mary Kane goes on to describe the psychological effect all this had on her.
I felt so scared, I felt so alone, and I felt so trapped. And I started to have suicidal thoughts. I started to cut myself. Some people saw me cutting myself. And, nobody really did anything or said anything.
And Nike say they're going to launch an investigation into all of this. They say these are deeply troubling allegations which have not been raised by Mary or her parents before. Salazar said he did support Mary Kane's health and welfare, and he denied many of her claims. But there are other athletes who were there at the time, and they've backed her up. Now, the most worrying aspect of this story is that the athlete's experiences seem to be far from unique, not confined to this Nike Oregon project, not confined to the US. Rebecca Myers writes for the Sunday Times. We've spoken to her on the show before, and she had a fascinating piece yesterday on the back of this Mary Kane story, where she talks to a bunch of British athletes, some on the record and some off, about the culture of the sport and the effect on their bodies and on their minds of trying to live up to all of the demands that are placed specifically on female athletes. Or certainly there are some differences to how the demands affect them compared to how they would affect male athletes. So Rebecca's going to be on to chat to us about what she found today.
And who wrote it?
I can't remember his name.
I'll tell you who wrote it.
It's been a while since our last episode of the I'll Tell You Wrote It Second Captain's Book Club, so we're bringing it back with a bang next month in front of a live audience at the Liberty Hall Theatre in Dublin as part of the Gang's All Here end of year Christmas shows. We've chosen the book. Don't reveal it yet, Murph.
Okay.
I didn't run this by you. I'm just
no,
teeing
okay,
it
I'm,
up.
I'm just, you know, I'm chomping at the bit here.
We have chosen the book reviewer, and we will give
it's
you...
It's actually champing at the bit, isn't it? It's not chomping.
It's champing at the bit,
yeah,
I believe.
Yeah, it's champing at the bit.
Both acceptable?
Can be either.
Can be either, yeah. Mm.
And we will.
I'd say it's probably just a case of people pronouncing the same word differently.
Oh.
And then what one just ends up getting accepted?
They just have different... end up with different spellings.
So we're going to give you all the details on the World Service this week, and you'll have plenty of time to read it in advance. What I will say is, this is not a 550-page grueler like the Joe DiMaggio book.
No, this is, you know, 3 or 4 days should see you right.
Oh, 3 or 4 days. Even I'm a slow reader, and I'm getting it done a lot quicker than that.
All right, Owen.
Nice. You know, I say
people,
that now.
People learn at different stages.
I'm saying I learn slowly. That's my point. It takes me ages to get through books, but I just...
Owen McDevitt reckons he can read it in under 3 days, which means you should be able to read it in about 2 hours.
I'm not doing any other work in those days, by the way. I'm just focusing on reading this book. So it is short, it is sweet, it is very readable, even for slow readers like myself. If you like great sports books and you enjoy this podcast, sign up to get involved in the next episode of the Second Captain's Book Club on secondcaptains.com/join. Those live shows, by the way, are all sold out. Our members picked the tickets off in a matter of hours after we announced them last week. You guys are amazing. Thanks once again to O'Hara's Irish Craft Beer for helping us put the shows together. There's a systemic crisis in women's sports in which young girls' bodies are being ruined by an emotionally and physically abusive system. Those are the words of Mary Kane, the youngest American track and field athlete to make a World Championships team a few years back. She was last week describing her experiences at the Nike Oregon Project. Rebecca Myers has spoken to a number of British athletes about some of these issues for the Sunday Times. Rebecca, good to chat to you again.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm just, I guess you got the idea to talk to British athletes based on that video, that Mary Kane video from last week?
Yeah, so this all broke on Thursday, the Mary Kane video on the New York Times website, and very much I saw it, you know, horrendous, shocking allegations, but truthfully there was part of me that wasn't so surprised, and I had this sort of immediate sense, you know, this is not just Mary Kane, this is not just the Nike Oregon Project, it's not just one coach. Part of that comes from, there was a brilliant campaign set up a year ago called Train Brave, and I'd sort of taken note of that at the time, and that was talking about Red S, which is a sort of when athletes lose a lot of weight and have massive problems with their energy levels and all of that. They were raising awareness of that. So I had a sense that there was something out there already, but I made a few calls to some athletes I knew had these kind of problems, athletes who hadn't but maybe had hinted at it in the past, and lo and behold, yeah, the picture started to become quite clear. And I think this is, it's a problem that is pervasive, it's absolutely everywhere. I think, you know, I mean, everyone I spoke to spoke about this kind of culture of thinner means faster. A lot of them said they think it comes from this kind of traditional way of training an athlete. So before we had a lot of the science and nutrition, and also when it was predominantly men, obviously to a degree with men, you know, losing weight can help. And I think a lot of that's been carried over to female athletes, but without really understanding the consequences for a female body. That said, we know that this is a huge problem among male athletes as well, and there's possibly even more stigma there. They're less likely to talk about it in some ways. So, yeah, I got a sense almost straight away that this was not an isolated incident.
Why are the effects of potentially similar training, treating your body in similar ways, different for women?
I think in particular what I found through these interviews and what's come to light since the Mary Kane case last week is that a lot of it centres around a woman's menstrual cycle. And the difficulty is that a lot of people don't understand, and certainly a lot of coaches don't seem to understand the consequences if a woman loses her menstrual period. So that happens once a woman kind of becomes under a certain weight. It's very hard to pinpoint what exact weight that is. It will depend on every different woman. But a lot of athletes were telling me, you know, they were sort of basically praised for not having a period. Either it was completely ignored and not seen as an issue at all. One athlete told me several British GPs she'd gone to and said, oh, well, you're a runner, you know, runners don't have periods, like it was not a big deal. You know, or even worse than that, it was considered kind of a good thing if you didn't have your period, because gosh, you were working so hard, you'd lost all this weight and now you weren't having a period. So yeah, pretty shocking. But I think what was then obviously missing was an understanding of what that means, and what it does mean is that it means your hormone levels are broken, then they're not working properly, and with that comes huge implications for particularly your bone health for women. So osteoporosis, problems like that, brittle bones. Mary Kane spoke about, I think it was 5 bones she said she'd broken. So I mean, quite serious implications, and then also implications for your future fertility, which these athletes are not being told about. So it's quite serious, and I think it's a combination sometimes of turning a blind eye and other times just actual genuine ignorance. Jackie Arison, who was also a South athlete, came out the other day, and she alleges that she was constantly questioned if and why I was on my period by that system. So this is a real, I think, red flag, pardon the pun, but definitely a red flag for athletes.
Can you just take us back a little bit, Rebecca, because, you know, I've no shame in admitting that I have very little knowledge of this subject. So is it a direct link between losing weight? Is it overtraining that can lead to women missing or losing their period? Or is it actually physical loss of weight that leads to that?
I suspect it can be both. I wouldn't know the exact science of how much and what kind of overtraining you would have to do, but obviously you are putting your body under a lot of stress. But you see a loss of periods in eating disorder cases very commonly. So women who suffer, for example, from anorexia may not have periods for many, many years, because you sort of send, I think part of it also, if you think about it, periods start at a later age. So you're kind of, if you've got the body of a very young girl because you've lost so much weight, I think that can be part of it. But I think overtraining can play a huge role in it. And overtraining looks very different to different athletes. You know, some athletes are encouraged to do it. Obviously, Mary Kane alleges that it was very much part of the system she was in. Other Salazar athletes have come out in recent, or former Salazar athletes have come out in recent days and said that, you know, they would leave the meal table hungry. That was encouraged. A British athlete I spoke to sort of said that her coach would make these comments about, well, do you need all those carbs? Like, do you really need all that food? You know, these sort of passive aggressive comments. But another athlete said to me, I did all my overtraining in secret. Nobody knew. My coach didn't have any idea, because she was so convinced that that would give her, you know, these mythical 1% we talk about all the time. And so she actually would finish her training program that her coach had set her, and then kind of secretly go back to the gym, and nobody even knew. So it really looks different for every athlete. But I think underpinning it is this idea, it is the win at all costs mentality. And unfortunately, you know, to be the best, I think a lot of athletes lose their way along that sort of path and think, well, to be the best, I've got to give absolutely everything. And that looks like, unfortunately, quite dangerous overtraining.
Yeah, I guess sometimes they're encouraged to lose their way. Maybe not. Maybe sometimes it is, it's unsaid. But sometimes it seems quite clearly that there is this relentless pressure put on them. You've spoke, interestingly, some of the, well, this is the way it works with a lot of articles, I guess. Some of the athletes seemed happy to speak to you on the record and tell you about their experiences. Others, not so much. There are some sort of unnamed athletes who speak quite interestingly. In general, did you find that women wanted to talk about this, wanted to highlight this as a problem?
Yes, they very much did. I was actually surprised at how many wanted to talk about it openly and to put their name to it. And I think for a lot of them, it's part of actually making sure this doesn't happen to other women. One woman in particular was saying to me that, you know, she's been recovered for a few years now, but girls come to her now and say, I haven't had my period in ages, and don't seem bothered by it. And so she's just seeing this repeated in front of her eyes, and I think for her, you know, she felt that actually it was part of her almost like a duty to kind of get this out there. And certainly we've seen that a lot in the since Mary Kane came out, a lot of other athletes are saying, I saw what happened with Mary, or I saw a glimmer of what was happening, perhaps not the whole picture, and I didn't speak out, and I feel really quite, you know, awful about that. Cara Goucher, who has, you know, made other allegations about Salazar in the past, but her husband wrote something quite sort of moving on Twitter and said that he'd been at a race where Salazar had said to Cara's mother and sister that she, you know, she still had her baby weight and she wasn't going to win if she looked like that, all of this stuff. So there's kind of a lot of women have come forward and actually their sort of role they feel to play is actually supporting Mary and adding to those allegations. So it's not a lone voice, you know, standing out on her own saying it happened to me. There are all these women now coming forward saying either I saw it happen to her or it happened to me too.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, Nike say they're investigating. Salazar himself disputes many of the claims that she has made. Just to get that there, we'll see what, if anything does come from the Nike investigation, who knows. But the physical stuff, like you speak to one athlete, Holly Rush, who was really badly affected. We're talking about broken bones and how there can be, you know, a lack of strength in the bones. This obviously can lead on to more serious stuff like osteoporosis and other issues in her case.
Yeah, absolutely. And Holly, you know, happily she's now recovered from her struggles with eating and everything now. And she's really healthy. She runs incredible kind of ultramarathons, mountain races and stuff. She's an amazing woman. But yeah, she said to me, you know, I don't necessarily know what the long-term effects are going to be. And they can't really tell you, you know, they can do us, you know, bone scans and they can give you a picture of how it's looking now, but they can't tell you what it's going to look like in sort of 30, 40 years. And she was very frank about that. And I found that, you know, really hard to listen to because, you know, as I think is quoted in the piece, she said, really, it was a couple of years of her life, you know, that she did this overtraining and she restricted her food in this way, but the impacts could be forever. And she said she doesn't know what the impacts on her fertility might be. you know, we've just, those are kind of things you just sort of wait to find out. And she said when she does, in recent years since she's recovered, when she has had an injury, it's kind of always a stress fracture or some kind of bone issue. So you can see that kind of all the way through. So one British athlete I spoke to who was in the American college system was talking quite a lot about how coaches over there can earn a bit more money. And she thinks there's a bit more of a kind of win at all costs culture because they only have you for a short period of time. So she was saying that there was less of an understanding of the kind of long-term welfare of the athlete, because really that coach has got you for sort of a couple of years and then you move on. This was a theme I heard a couple of times, people saying also elite sport is so competitive. If they break one athlete, they've got 50 other athletes, you know, ready and waiting to go the extra mile, go the extra 1% that they can then turn to. So I think there was a few athletes who raised that concern of maybe the bigger picture and the longer term effects on one person are not considered.
Those psychological effects that really hit Mary Kane hard, do you get that? Because we've talked a lot about the physical issues, but do you find that women who've gone through this and whose menstrual cycle is affected in these kind of ways, is there a big psychological impact of that if this goes on for a couple of years, 3, 4, 5 years in cases?
Yeah, I definitely think so. And I think, I think it shouldn't be lost in the discussion, which obviously, as you said, has been quite often focused on the physical side. I think, just for a start, if you have disordered eating, if you have problems around food and difficulty with your self-image and weight, those are issues that will be with you for a lifetime. Plenty of people who've recovered from eating disorders say you'll never... you know, you may be recovered, but you always live with that, you know, whether it's a struggle, whether it's a, you know, whenever you pick up food, there's some kind of internal battle going on. I think that that can last a lifetime and certainly at minimum will take a certain amount of therapy or help with a specialist. So just on one level, there's that. I think also certainly what came out of the Mary Kane story is just how isolating it is. You know, She felt incredibly alone. I spoke to other athletes, their parents had no idea because they were often training away from home, you know, whether that's just a few cities away or whether that's hundreds of miles away in another country. One athlete said to me, she came home for Christmas and her parents were absolutely horrified. They just looked at her and were like, oh my God, look at you, because they just had no idea. You know, they were speaking on the phone, etc., while she's been away for 6 months. So I think the isolation of it is very real and very serious. And obviously Mary Kane in particular spoke about that for her manifesting eventually as up to suicidal thoughts and self-harming. So I think we have to be really clear that this is not just a physical risk, which it is as well, but actually quite a serious mental health problem.
What about the argument, Rebecca, that sometimes thinner is better? You know, I'm trying not to sound too callous about it, but we're talking about professional sport here. And of course, people have to be right on top of their bodies and their nutrition. And they do have to, there is that line, you do sort of have to do a bit more than the person beside you is doing in terms of training if you do want to be the one to make it. I don't know if they're old fashioned tropes. I think surely there is still an element of that actually, to get to the very top of any sport with a lot of depth in it, you do have to do things that seem a little bit abnormal, and maybe it can be hard to know where the grey areas are.
Absolutely. I think the point about grey areas is bang on. I mean, this is ultimately, nowadays, if you're talking about elite sport, you are talking about nutrition, you are talking about marginal gains. And ultimately, it is, in some ways, it's a spectrum from things that we can, you know, that every athlete I ever interview talks about, not having cake, not having wine, not having, you know, whether that's too many carbs or cheese or whatever it is for them that's on their plan. In some way, that's restrictive eating. So if you're starting from that base level, you're right, there are lots of grey areas on the way to full disordered eating, and different people will have their takes on whether that in itself is disordered eating or do you have to sort of go further than that. It's such
But my point, I suppose, is, and I'm not talking about Salazar here, but, you know, in other cases that a coach might feel he's doing the right thing by making sure an athlete under his charge, whether it's male or female, is constantly thinking about their weight, that actually you certainly for something like long distance running, I mean you are going to be, you probably need to be thin.
Yeah, I think we don't have the answer to that. I think, you know, it's so normal for coaches to think about weight in to a degree, or certainly nutrition, which is kind of part and parcel of the same thing often. And one of the athletes I spoke to said to me, you know, people said thinner meant faster, but nobody said up to a point. And I think that's probably what's getting lost here is, well, for men as well, but particularly for women, because of that fine balance with the menstrual cycle, losing weight may help you. It may become advantageous, but at some point it starts to become dangerous and disadvantageous. And I think that really, really fine boiling point is what people don't know yet. And obviously that needs, you know, a coach to look at every single individual athlete. That will not be the same for every athlete. But yeah, it's such a difficult question to answer. And like you said, coaches often will think they're doing the right thing. That there's plenty of material out there. There's books on, race weight or running weight or whatever you want to call it. This is completely above board. So it's quite hard to answer. Yeah. At what point does that turn into something that is worrying?
This is one of those things. When I saw that video last week, the more you kind of cover sport, the more conversations you have, the more grim it seems to be in a lot of ways. Obviously with women's sports, say in particular, the participation rates have been so good recently and there's been more exposure and all that kind of stuff that's happened in the UK, it's happened in Ireland, it seems to be happening internationally. I don't know if people might be worried listening, thinking, geez, I don't want my daughter getting into top level sport if this is the kind of stuff that goes on. Like, how is it possible to get to the top of those kind of sports like athletics without risking going down roads like we're talking about today?
I'd hope so. And I certainly hope that, things are changing and times are changing. I think certainly we've got more research going on and more awareness of a female body than ever before. Also, women are able to talk about this. I spoke to one dietitian who said that, a few years ago, you couldn't really, there would be a lot more taboo about saying when your period was or if you'd had one. Whereas now athletes talk about that all the time. The US soccer team, I was talking to someone the other day who said, another journalist, who said one of their best read articles was when the US soccer team came out and talked about their period after the World Cup and how they'd managed their menstrual cycles. So things are changing fast and they're changing for the better. But obviously, we need more work to be done. And I think, hopefully what we'll also see is more female coaches going in, more female nutritionists. Mary Kane was absolutely clear in her video. She said she thought if there'd been more of those, she wonders if she would have had the same problems. That was sort of the implication. She said, I wonder where I'd be today. I'm not sure it's quite as simple as that. I certainly have also heard stories of female coaches doing the same. Ultimately, they also just want people to win. But I think it will help, certainly, and it will help drive more research and more understanding of what a female athlete needs. So I think we have to be optimistic. We have to be hopeful and also celebrate the fact that we have a culture where people can come forward and receive the sort of support and praise that Mary has done for coming forward and saying this, because you have to wonder if even 10 years ago, whether she would have been listened to.
Yeah, even some of the athletes who were with her at the time have sort of apologized to her publicly and maybe even privately for not supporting her more at the time, for not really understanding what she was going through. So yeah, hopefully some positive stuff has come out of it. Listen, Rebecca, really good. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about that.
Thanks so much, Owen. That's great.
Fair to say anybody could have managed those guys?
No, of course not.
He was about 12. Everyone in the city knew about him, but no one had seen him.
Look how happy I was. What the fuck happened? No, really. What happened? What happened?
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Got an email in here from Fionnuala O'Toole with a very long subject title.
Okay.
Singing the anthem with passion is associated with better match outcomes. I see your eye. Ken's eyebrows literally raised there. They both just raised up. This is interesting.
Is this a scientific study?
Yeah, it is a scientific study, Ken.
Go on.
Hi, lads. Came across this paper in a scientific journal today suggesting...
For you, Ken. Here.
Well, just because it's in a scientific journal doesn't mean it's true.
But there are scientific...
I was just trying to establish... It sounded like the title of a paper rather than
it is.
An email.
Fionnuala's kept it short and sweet. She's just basically said, look, this is amazing. Apparently, we can beat Denmark if we just... cheer the hell out of our national anthem. Sent on the study, which I'm not going to bother reading.
Is this
going to be very long?
Is this the players or the crowd?
The present research. Oh, hang on. That's not the official anthem, though, Simon. Yeah, it feels about the rise next
you
year.
You can bring that down again now.
The present research examined the link between passion displayed by team members, forget about it. It's all down to James McLean, basically, during the singing of national anthems in the UEFA games and some of the results. Drawing on social identity theorizing, we hypothesized a positive relationship between passion and performance. Consistent with this hypothesis, results showed that teams that sang national anthems with greater passion went on to concede fewer goals. So it seems to be particularly defensive play that benefits from all this. Moreover, results provided evidence that the impact of passion and the likelihood of winning a game depended on the stage of the competition. In the knockout stage, greater passion was associated with a greater likelihood of victory.
This is amazing because, I mean, we're only watching the Rugby World Cup final between three-time winners Argentina and four-time winners Italy. And I thought exactly the same thing on.
Extending recent reviews that highlight the importance of social identity processes in sporting contexts. I don't know what that means. These results suggest that team members' identity-based expression of passion for the collective can be an important predictor of subsequent performance. Amazing research, Ken, or
I don't
complete
know what you're
nonsense.
Talking about.
I'm with Vincent on this one.
Not for me.
They lost me at...
For me, not for me.
They lost me at knockout stage. Group phase, maybe. I don't know. One team, not fully... They might think there's another... They don't have to win every game. Knockout stage, are you really going to lose because... James McLean is bawling his eyes out over the national anthem on the other side.
I'm fucking raging.
I don't know. They obviously were at the France-Ireland game. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, you know. We remember France Brazil 7, Germany 1 in that World Cup semi-final.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, well, look, it's not exhaustive. Let's just say that. Simon, Saracens spending beyond their means means rugby is screwed. Does it?
Well, this current story is about Saracens and the English League, obviously. But Michael Aylwin, who we'll have on, was writing in The Guardian saying... Rugby thinks it can be like football, thinks sometimes it has a moral duty to be, but rugby's not big enough. Until an overhaul of its governance structures is implemented, crises such as the current one will remain hardwired into the system. Essentially saying the system is a sitting duck for millionaires like Ray or others who are going to seek financial loopholes. So they might clean up this Saracens mess, but there's going to be another one along soon enough.
Shane Horgan's on the line to talk about this, talk about the Saracens saga and what it might tell us about the future of the sport. Hi, Shane.
How you doing?
Pretty good, yeah. And joining us this week is Mike Aylwin, who is the author of a book called Unholy Union, When Rugby Collided with the Modern World. He's been writing about this topic. Michael, thanks very much for chatting.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So Shane, the broad strokes of this were discovered late last week. There's this 35 point deduction and £5 million fine that Saracens have been hit with. Since then, it's been quite noticeable that players and representatives of rival clubs have been lining up to really jump in here and have a go at Saracens, which isn't always the way it happens in these situations. They themselves seem to be standing their ground and are quite defiant about the whole thing. I don't think they think they've done anything wrong. What's your initial reaction to what's been going on over the last few days?
Well, I'd like to know what Saracens have done wrong, because I can't seem to get to the bottom of it. I know they've got the fine and the points deduction, but the actual reasoning behind the decision, it's unclear to me, and I don't see that it's readily available. Maybe Michael can shed some light on it. There has been a lot of talk about these investment vehicles that are being used by players. My understanding is that they aren't part of the breach of the salary cap. There's some technical or quite insignificant breaches of the rules around reporting of some of these vehicles, but certainly not enough to constitute a £5 million fine and 35-point deduction. Also that there's no current breach of the salary cap. So it's very hard to have an opinion on this, or an informed opinion, until we know exactly what Saracens have done wrong and whether... that large of a fine and that many points deduction is correct.
Mike, inform us then. What's your understanding of what crimes they've committed here?
I think it is telling that more or less the first thing they said in their statement was to breach this strict confidentiality agreement that surrounds the whole thing by saying that they were pleased the panel had acknowledged that they had not deliberately misled anybody or breached the cap. Now, that's quite an important point to make if it's true, and we have to assume it is true. The fact that Premier Rugby didn't see fit to mention that does, I think, hint at what Saracens might be up against here. There's a lot of ill will towards them. The truth is, as Shane says, we're all, to a degree, stumbling around in the dark, and yet that's not stopping people from all around the game coming out and shooting from the hip as if... this news has somehow come as a sort of catharsis to their ongoing frustrations that, Saracens must be cheating, they must be cheating.
Why are they getting 35 points deducted? This is what I don't get.
I agree. I mean, what is going on here? I mean, if if they haven't deliberately misled anybody, then why are they being clobbered? As I said in my piece on yesterday, and say we say it in the book, the problem, apart from anything else, is the way the Premiership is governed. Basically, the power is still wielded by the chairman, i.e. by those who are furiously competing with each other. They're all egotistical maniacs.
Shane, I want to bring you back in here, because I am quite struck by the tone of the criticisms we played Danny Kerr. In fairness, we were celebrating this last week and Chris Robshaw was speaking out and others at the Heineken Cup launch, and Danny Kerr we played earlier on, and it is great to hear players have opinions, because oftentimes they won't say anything about other clubs no matter what. Whereas in this case, it seems like everyone's been quite quick to lay into Saracens. What is it about this club? Is it just because they've been winning a lot recently, or is there something about Saracens that everyone else in England just does not like?
I think there's two things. One, that they've been consistently winning on a grand scale for a long time. That doesn't sit well with anyone. And then the second one is, you know, you talk to anybody involved in rugby, even tangentially in the UK for the last maybe 10 years, and they'll say they've heard rumours of Saracens contravening the salary cap. So it's almost like you guys have got where you are because you've cheated. We all knew you were cheated, and now we've got you. So, and as Michael pointed out there, this time maybe our hands are a little bit cleaner, because there's certainly in instances before, Saracens weren't on their own. There was, you know, many, many other teams that were considered to be in contravention of the cap as well. And now it seems to conveniently have boiled down to only Saracens, and, you know, maybe people are feeling they're a little bit cleaner. But it still gets back to the most basic point here, that unless there's more transparency from Premier Rugby as to what they have done, if they haven't misled Prem Rugby, if they haven't breached the cap on purpose, then, you know, this does seem like a really extraordinarily, large fine and point deduction. But if they have, or there's something else behind it, we need to know. And they may have confidentiality agreements within their structures. But, you know, they could potentially be waived. And you're not going to be able to have a proper debate on this unless people know what actually they're dealing with. And it's not just good enough to say they've done it. You've got to say, what have they done, how long they've done it for, what impact it had, did they knowingly do it? All these things are important in the guilt or otherwise of Saracens, their punishment, and how they're perceived, and how other people are judged. Now, you know, I don't have any particular love for the Saracens team, but I would say, you know, I would find it difficult to destroy them without knowing fully what they've done. And there has been a lot of frustration, I think, has come out in the last few days with players going, well, we always knew they did it, so let's pile in here. It may be the case that they have done it, and I wouldn't be surprised if they have, but we need to know. We need to have some transparency from Prem Rugby. They need to explain their case a bit better.
Shane, do you see this as an English problem, a Saracens problem, or do you think rugby as a business is fundamentally flawed?
Our rugby as a business doesn't work, you know, all around the world. I think it just doesn't work. And it's certainly, you know, we know the challenges involved in football in the UK outside of the Premier League. And even then, sport is notorious outside the US, notoriously difficult to make money. And there's the old adage, you know, how do you make a small fortune in rugby? You start with a big one. And that's the basis for a lot of these clubs and how they're run, that it's a philanthropic enterprise. And that's certainly the case with Saracens. Now, there's something to be said for a philanthropic enterprise. You know, if there's enough rich people that are interested in rugby and, you know, choose to run it on that basis, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. But it's the idea of having a sustainable model where all teams in the Premiership wash their own faces, that's never been achievable. And I don't know how realistic it is to even suggest that that's the line that that people are striving towards. Maybe it's a better method is to find more philanthropic owners who are willing to take a £50 million bath over the course of 25 years.
Yeah. Michael, you think maybe the crux of this issue is player wages. They're too high. The sport can't support itself. But then you look at professional sport worldwide, in the history of it, has the sport ever gone backwards in terms of wages?
No, exactly. And this was football for until quite recently, really. And in a lot of areas, it still is. I don't think the problem of English clubs throwing more money around than they generate is about to go away. Some people think, not unreasonably, that the RFU, for example, are sitting back and waiting for the clubs just to go bust, and then they can step in and start, reorganising the sport around the way they want it.
Shane, Mark McCall, the Saracens director of rugby, suggested this weekend that they're going to be strategic about this season, assuming they do have to start with this, or they do have to continue with this points deduction. This presumably means that the European Cup is going to be secondary. Does that devalue that competition, which is obviously starting later this week?
I suppose to some degree it does, whether...
I don't think any of the other top contenders would be necessarily complaining. I don't want to be too pious about the whole thing.
No, and also let's just see how that pans out as well. Saracens always have one eye on the Premiership as well. So it's not as if they go into the European games and forget about everything else. I think a part of operating in the English or the French league is trying to fight on two fronts, and they've been successful in doing that for a long time. It's not like their success in Europe has come at the expense of what they've been doing in the Premier. So I think maybe it's a useful tool for Mark. Let's see what their selection is like. And as I said at the start, I don't think they've been found guilty of breaching the salary cap this year, so they don't have to make any reductions to their current squad. So, if you look at the numbers of points that they've racked up over the last number of years, when they have had great success in Europe, I think each of those times it's been enough to, if that points deduction were made, it would be enough to ensure that they stayed in the top flight.
Yeah, Shane, great stuff. Mike Elwin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Emil.
We've got that bit better quality. And we just got to make it count. It might be a knob end. Is it too much to ask? In 91st minute, that wins it.
So basically, any chance you train? I think Roy said something under his breath about Johnny or something.
You're always on the team of deal. Never fuck.
Roy is Roy, isn't he? I'm sure there's lessons to be learned by everybody.
And Harry was just going, Roy, I'm not speaking to you like this. I'm not listening to you.
When I got the sack at Sheffield United, the only guy that spoke to me was Roy Keane. I'll never forget that. And I thought that was a bit of class.
We've got that bit better quality. And we've just got to make it count.
He called me f***ed.
It might be a knob end in 91st minute that wins it.
Murph, I see the great young talent of Gaelic football was at it again.
David Clifford!
That's the boy there, yeah. He seemed to be there. A lot of pictures of him very, very passionate after winning for his club.
Yeah, 8,000 people. Well, for his division, of course. Owen.
Well, that doesn't count.
No, the one thing we're not going to do here, Owen, is start talking about the rather complicated system by which Kerry decide what the best club or divisional team is in that county in any given year. Suffice to say, East Kerry, in the Kerry County Championship final yesterday against Dr. Crokes, going for four in a row. Clifford, inspirational again, scored a brilliant goal, 14 yards out, stuck in the top corner, into the, hit the stanchion in the back. Aesthetically,
that's nice.
Very, very pleasing.
The best ones, if it comes back further from where the shot was taken, that's ideal. Just hit the stanchion and bounce back towards midfield.
You're asking for a lot there. I'm sure Clifford, given time, will get around to it. Probably. But 8,000 people at a club final in November. The Kerry County Board can probably thank Clifford for, 2,000 or 3,000 of those. This is how good this guy is. This is how excited we all are.
And how consistent he is. He just seems to do it every time.
Yeah, it is phenomenal. Like, in so many ways, he's the most talked about footballer in Ireland. And in other ways, I actually think we don't talk about him enough.
Well, I made that point last year. Albeit now, just before we go too nuts, this is a club match in which he should be excelling. And he should be. But it's the fact that he's done it in almost every game I've watched him for Kerry, he seems to pop up.
Yeah, and, you know, he was being marked by two inter-county players, you know, one in front of him, one behind him yesterday, you know. I mean, if you're planning on beating East Kerry, you know, the game plan isn't that difficult to figure out. You know, if you manage to stop David Clifford having an impact on the game, you're probably going to have a pretty good day. But he's played two seasons of inter-county football. He's won two All-Stars. That's as many as Jeremy Connolly won in his entire career, by the way. Like, it's pretty good going. I mean, there was, interestingly, on Saturday I read a really good article by Tony Lean in The Examiner, and it was basically in interviews with Mikey Sheehy, Morris Fitzgerald and Colin Cooper about how good David Clifford is. And honestly, I mean, that's ridiculous. The guy's played two seasons. What the hell are you doing talking to three, like, bona fide, you know, maybe in the top 10 forwards of all time about how good this guy could be? He doesn't deserve that. And on the other hand, you're like, yeah, I still probably think Clifford's going to be better than all three of them.
Well, Colin Cooper got the same stuff. He was getting a lot of that from the very start as well. And there was a bit of, oh, maybe he shouldn't. But I think people in Kerry realised, don't worry, this guy is really good. He can handle all this.
Yeah. And an interesting aside to all of that was that Mikey Sheehy retired in 87 and Morris Fitz came on the scene the year after. Morris Fitz retired and Colin Cooper came on the scene.
I'm sure they're only keeping the jersey, Murph. They're trying to hand it on in a better place than where they found it.
It is kind of ridiculous, though, that none of the four of them played together, but Kerry has had one of those four playing every year since 1974. I mean, you know, it's a pretty annoying but pretty lucky for Kerry sequence of events. But yeah, I mean, like, I'm going to go home and watch GA Govilas Nidig at 8 o'clock tonight on TG Carr, which is something even I don't do all that regularly because I know that I'll be able to watch some David Clifford goodness.
Non-members, I cannot believe it's going to be next Monday by the time we get to talk to you again. Unbelievable. Join up now. We'll chat to you during the week. There's loads going on. The rest of it, we'll see you tomorrow. Thanks, Murph. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Owen. Thank you, Ken.
Thanks a million for listening.
Thank you, Owen.
Bye-bye.
That's the second time it's gone off.
Those boys. Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.